Ralph Bader was presenting public lecture to cultivate and preserve Jewish perspective on the environment, October 24th, 2004.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Simbel, and thank you for all coming tonight. I know that Sunday evening there's plenty to do, particularly this time of year. I just want to begin with a little story, which is kind of an updating of a parable offered by the Dubner Maggid, but it's updated, as you will see. The story involves an obsessive-compulsive individual who needed to be fully prepared for whatever situation he was encountering, and upon his retirement, he was planning on taking his first trip to Israel. But being told that there was a seven-hour stopover in France, he devoted the entire year before the trip to learning French because he wanted to be fully prepared to speak French, to order Coca-Cola at the airports. And, of course, he did so, and after a year, he was fairly fluent. He landed in Charles de Gaulle Airport. He spoke French like a native. But lo and behold, when it was time to go to Israel, he realized with a sinking feeling that he had never bothered to study. He was so preoccupied for the stopover that he had not concerned himself with the primary destination. Without trying to be depressing, the Dubner Maggid writes that this is really our situation. We live in this world. We are of this world, of course. But ultimately, the only thing that counts in our life are the good deeds that we've done, the Torah that we've studied. And although it is true that as long as we live in this world, we have to occupy ourselves with what is necessary for our sustenance, but if one is so involved in the stopover that they forget the ultimate destination, they are being quite short-sighted. So I do want to congratulate you here for being concerned with issues of perhaps ultimate importance as opposed to the many, many other interesting and fun things that one can do Sunday night. So it really is to your credit that you've come to study a little bit of Torah. The topic tonight is not as dramatic as some of the other things I've talked about. I've talked about cloning, genetic engineering, nuclear war, all sorts of exciting and controversial issues. Tonight we're talking about something that's a little less flamboyant and exciting, but in fact more relevant and practical to the conduct of our daily lives. Sometimes we don't like to hear things that are relevant to our daily lives. We prefer to hear things that have no relevance to our life because then it doesn't challenge the way we live. And that is our relationship to the environment from a Jewish perspective. And there are really three issues that I want to address, although I don't think I'll be able to give you a complete overview of everything. Number one, I would like to demonstrate some of the halachic principles that are extracted from the Talmud and from the codes regarding what our approach should be towards environmental concerns. I think that an authentic Jewish philosophy is normally something that is extracted from a variety of specific rulings, and I think if you connect the dots, you see a general picture that can be drawn. Number two, from a philosophical standpoint, what are the philosophical values that are behind the halachic rulings? And number three, where would we part with the environmental movement? Meaning, on one hand, there's a lot of convergence. On one hand, I'll tell you up front, that a Jewish perspective, and of course I can't say I'm giving the Jewish perspective, but the perspective I will articulate is something that is broadly supportive of the environmentalist goals, but at the same time we would part company with some of the methods that they would employ. So those are kind of the three issues that I hope to address tonight. Let me begin by noting that one of the striking phenomena of modern urbanized life is how distant we are from the grandeur and beauty of nature. We see less, we notice less. In the ancient world, people were exquisitely attuned and sensitive to the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets. Today, the growing cycles of the crops, the ripening of the fruits, all of these were things that were daily occurrences in the life of people. People saw it. Children were raised to be sensitive to all of these phenomena. Today, we have largely become urbanized. In fact, the Jews are known as an urban people primarily. There are not too many Jewish farmers. We have some in Israel, a few in Vermont, but not much more. Ben and Jerry or whatever, they went corporate, so they don't count anymore either. And our children today grow up believing that chocolate milk comes from brown cows and tomatoes grow in the produce bins at Giants. That's kind of the way the attitude is. And yet we can clearly see that the fundamental religious orientation of the Torah was based on a sensitivity to these natural phenomena. Let us take the pilgrimage festivals. We know that there are three pilgrimage festivals where everybody had to go to Jerusalem three times a year, and these were Pesach, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot. And today we tend to identify them as primarily religious and historical commemorations. We think of Passover, and rightly so, as the anniversary of the Exodus from slavery. We think of Shavuot as the day that God gave us the Ten Commandments, and we think of Sukkot as commemorating the travels of our forefathers in the desert. However, if you look in the Torah itself, the Torah emphasizes a very strong agricultural motif for each of those festivals. Passover is not only the anniversary of the Exodus, but it is the ripening of the barley, which is the first crop. Shavuot, just 50 days later, is not only the giving of the Torah, as important as that is, of course, but it is the wheat harvest. And Sukkot, coming at the beginning of the fall and the end of the summer, is the ingathering of the fruits. The Torah specifically wanted us to commemorate those cycles of growth and harvest. And indeed, the Maharal of Prague, one of the great mystic philosophers of Judaism in the 16th century, sees a correlation between physical phenomena and spiritual realities. He points out, for example, that the reason Pesach is the time of liberation from Egypt is because that is the time after the long dormant winter that the ground now becomes liberated from its enslavement. In other words, what is happening in a physical sense corresponds to spiritual ideas. If Shavuot is the wheat harvest, that corresponds to Matan Torah, because that is our ability to harvest knowledge and insight. If Sukkot is the ingathering of the produce into the home, that corresponds to our ability after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to integrate our knowledge into our psychological and emotional life. You see, the physical and the spiritual have counterparts. That is why the halacha is so emphatic that the three pilgrimage festivals be aligned with the harvest cycle of the land of Israel. That is why we have a leap year this year. Because as you know, the Jewish lunar calendar is only 354 days. It is approximately 11 days on a fraction short. And consequently, Passover and all the holidays would progressively become earlier and earlier and earlier in the year, just like Ramadan in the Islamic calendar can become any time of year. Well, but the Torah insists that Passover be in the spring. And whenever Pesach gets too early, we add an extra month of Adar to push Pesach late. Of course, you know, people always say, Rosh Hashanah is early this year. Not really. Rosh Hashanah is always the first of Tishrei. Pesach is always the 15th of Nisan. You know, that date never changes. But early obviously means in relationship to the calendar. So basically, this was the idea of being attuned to nature, because that made a person sensitive to the spiritual vibes that were in the air. Of course, since we've been in the Galut, since we've been in the diaspora, we were distanced from our land. And as those of you who are students of history know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Jews were not even allowed to own real estate. And as a result, gradually, we and our children and our ancestors became separated and distant and no longer had that connection, till the image of the Jew as sharp businessman, which has many, many anti-Semitic repercussions, became a very fixed description in the constellation of stereotypes. Besides the Shalosh Regalim, let me point out something else which is connected to the natural cycle. Prayers, right? In our ritual, we have prayers three times a day, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, the evening prayer. These prayers are designed to correspond to transition points. The morning prayer, ideally, although we tend to get up later, should be prayed as the sun comes up. And the Mincha prayer should be prayed as the sun is going down. And the Maariv prayer should be prayed when it's dark and you see the stars in the sky. And keep in mind that although we pray with electric light, so it's the same if it's morning, afternoon, or night, but originally the very timing of these prayers was designed to arouse spiritual emotions within a person. Morning is a time of optimism and hope as the sun goes up. So the dominant mood of the Shacharit prayer is one of hope as the new day beckons. And Mincha, which is prayed as the sun is going down, fills a person with fear and trepidation in which they beseech God to give them another chance. And Maariv, which is prayed when it's totally dark, is an affirmation of our faith in God, even at times of despair. Darkness, which gives us the courage to persevere in the midst of adversity. Now, is this what Shacharit triggers within us? Do we feel Mincha? I mean, you know, basically, you know, Shacharit, Mincha, Maariv is all the same. Because we have our light, we have our artificial situation where one doesn't even know what's going on outside. But the whole concept was that one would live his life in accordance with the cycles of the natural worlds. And that would reawaken emotions and feelings and thoughts that correspond to those physical realities. Once again, this is illustrative of how distant we have become from the earth, from the sky, from the water, from the stars, from the sun. And as a result, not only have we despoiled the environment, but we have lost a significant dimension of religious consciousness, which is connected to one's attachment to the natural phenomena of the universe. Often you hear, people like to blame Jews for everything, and you often hear that the Judeo-Christian ethic is often blamed for the attitudes that destroy the environment. And the verse that is cited is Genesis chapter 1, where Adam and Eve are created, and God puts Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and it says, Kru urvu, be fruitful and multiply, umilu et haaretz, fill the land, v'kivshuha. Kivshuha means conquer it, dominate it, control it. So the argument goes, if the biblical mandate is to master nature, to control nature, to dominate nature, instead of living in harmony with nature, that is a license to abuse the environment. So do many, some environmentalists say, and they say the Jews are to blame for this as they are to blame for everything else. However, as is always the case, one cannot take any biblical verse or passage out of context. And it is true that Genesis chapter 1 uses the verb conquest and domination. But Genesis chapter 2 gives an additional mission, and that is liavda ulashamra, to work the garden, to cultivate the garden, to preserve the garden. There are indeed two different missions which to some degree are in tension with each other, but we have to strike a balance. There is the notion indeed that man is given the mission to control the environment. We are not supposed to simply be quiescent and put ourselves in the path of floods and disease. We're supposed to try to do something in which the forces of nature will not wreak havoc upon our lives. Right? One certainly doesn't say, if a flood is coming, it's the will of God, therefore I shouldn't try to stop it. At the same time, that ability to control and dominate and channel the natural forces must be in the context of, again, it's used more often by Christians, but it's a perfectly appropriate word, in the context of what is called responsible stewardship, in which, yes, we are in charge of this natural world. God gave us this world to populate and inhabit and to direct and channel in positive ways, but we must do so with responsibility, and we must do so with a sense of stewardship. And indeed, Rav Soloveitchik points out in his very great essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, that Adam in chapter 1 is described as being made in the image of God. But Adam in chapter 2 is described as being made from the dust of the earth. And he calls these two typologies Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 gives the human being a sense of their grandeur, a sense of their power, a sense of their ability to accomplish in the world. But Adam 2 reminds the human being of our humility, in our need to have submission to the divine. If all you have is Adam 1, that leads to an arrogance, abuse of the world and other people. If all you have is Adam 2, you have paralysis, despair, and inaction. It is only the combination of I'm in the image of God and I'm of the dust of the earth that gives me the balance between humility and accomplishment that is needed to live in the world and relate to others in a responsible and sensitive way, but at the same time recognize the imperative of action. In fact, I don't want to go too far afield, but that is actually the great symbolism of Brit Milah, of circumcision. people ask the question, you know, there's an anti-circumcision movement in the United States where people raise the question, if God wanted Jewish boys to be circumcised, why didn't he create them circumcised? Are we improving on God's creation? Is it not a mutilation? And this is not a new question. This question, in fact, was raised hundreds of years ago, actually 2,000 years ago. A Roman matron asked Rabbi Akiva this very question. And Rabbi Akiva gave a mashal, he gave the following analogy. When God created seeds of wheat, God did not create bread that grows on trees. Why doesn't God create a steak tree and an ice cream tree and a bread tree? Rather, God truncated the creative process at some point because God is saying we are to be his partners in rectifying creation. And therefore, Rabbi Akiva said to this Roman matron, God, as it were, did not perfect the human being because he left it to us to become his collaborative partners. And that's really the notion of partnership with the divine. So that's Adam 1. Adam 2 reminds us we're the junior partner in the equation, that we're not exactly co-equal in this way. Okay, so this is a general topic in terms of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and therefore I do think, regardless of perhaps how people have misinterpreted it, that a total reading of the Genesis story does couple man's power and control with the need of stewardship and responsibility in the exercise of those powers. So you have to read the two chapters to get the entire picture. Now, let me just say a few words about the fact that I'll be coming to my first issue. I'll be giving you a number of specific halachot. And let me just mention a little bit about what I'm doing. Those of you who are students of Jewish law, if you've studied the Talmud and the like, one of the things that you will notice, of course, is that the Talmud often does not issue general proclamations. The Talmud does not simply say, it's good to take care of the environment and leave it like that. Rather, the Talmud will have a bunch of specific rulings, cases, as it were, sometimes subject to dispute, sometimes not subject to dispute. And essentially, one can extract a philosophical idea or a value system, not from anything that is explicitly stated, but by simply connecting all the dots by examining all of the rulings. In other words, it is primarily an inductive system rather than a deductive system. We examine all the data as codified in a whole bunch of discrete and limited rulings, and we try to get a picture from those particular rulings. Now, Paul's great critique of Judaism, one of his critiques of Judaism going back to the time of Jesus, was that Judaism, the covenant, the old covenant, so to speak, was an unduly legalistic system. Too many rules and regulations in which human beings cannot live up to. And consequently, the notion was, let us replace works with primarily faith. But it's been well known, and this has been observed over and over again, that Judaism, at least in its halakhic incarnation, is a very, very legalistic religion. Rule after rule after rule after rule. There's a blessing when you go to the bathroom, and there's even rules about the right shoe before the left shoe. I mean, there are all sorts of, there are rules covering everything. And people sometimes say, why so many rules? Why doesn't God just say, be a good person, and leave it like that? Why does the Talmud spend thousands and thousands of pages on so many legal rulings? And fundamentally, what this means is that Judaism has a very healthy mistrust of abilities of human beings standing alone to formulate a consistent value system. And the reason is because far too often we will define the good to be whatever is expedient based on whatever it is we want at a given time. Meaning, giving the person total discretion to decide, you know, what's good leads to very horrendous results. Again, just to take an extreme situation. The Holocaust came out of a philosophy and a belief system that it would be a good thing to rid the world of the vermin that were called the Jewish people. And one can convince themselves of anything. And consequently, the halakhic system is based on the idea that discretion to a certain degree needs to be circumscribed and defined in legalistic categories. Because only then is one given the proper direction and guidance as to how they should live their life. Now, that's not to say that halakha has no gray areas. There are many, many gray areas. There are many, many issues that are not clearly addressed. But the structure of the halakhic system does provide a person with points of reference that one would not have if one is simply thrown on their own discretion in terms of developing a life. So as a result, well, just give you an example. We have a book, a whole book, written by the great sage, the Chafetz Chaim, about the laws of prohibited gossip. What is prohibited gossip? What is not prohibited gossip? Lashon Hara. It's about a 500-page book. Now, one would say, why don't you just say, you know, don't speak badly about people unless you have a good reason. Just say that. I need 500 pages? Well, the answer is yeah, because if the rule would be, don't speak badly about people unless you have a good reason, we would come up with all sorts of good reasons to do that. And the Chafetz Chaim goes back to the Talmud and tells us what's a good reason, what's not a good reason. Okay, so this is just a comment on the so-called legalistic nature of halakhic Judaism, which some have criticized as being blind to broader values, but which I am suggesting is in fact a source for fundamental values, although those fundamental values are not always articulated in the specific halakhic ruling. Meaning one has to have an eye to be able to discern from the mass of specific case law, so to speak, what exactly is going on, what is the ultimate message that these halakhas are going to tell us. So let me start with some specific halakhic concepts and their bearing on environmental concerns. The most obvious text in the Torah itself that bears upon the environment is a prohibition in the book of Deuteronomy that says, when you go out to war and you make a siege against your enemies, you are prohibited to cut down fruit-bearing trees. It says, Lo sashchitz, eitz, do not destroy trees, because the pasuk says, Ki ha'adam eitz asadeh, is the tree your enemy, that you should cut down the tree. Now, Maimonides, based on the Talmud, says that this is not simply a particularized prohibition against the destruction of trees, but it's a general rule that one should not needlessly waste any type of resources. In fact, Maimonides gives an interesting example. Let's say I want to discipline my child, and one of the ways I want to do this, again, psychologists would not endorse this, is I want to smash something on the table to scare my kid. So besides the psychological trauma you might be giving your kid, in addition, that is prohibited because that is needless and wanton destruction of assets. So certainly, once we expand the Baal Tashchit, Baal is simply the rabbinic term for low, the Lo Tashchit, do not destroy, beyond the specific case of fruit trees, and it becomes a general imperative for the conservation of resources, then obviously it strongly supports programs such as recycling, reusable supplies, even renewable sources of energy, because one is indeed commanded, as it were, not to needlessly waste that which could be preserved. Again, I will point out it's a bit more complicated than that, because obviously if all things are equal, better to recycle than not, but then you get into all sorts of very difficult questions. What if the costs of recycling are greater than the costs of making new things? Obviously, there needs to be a comparative benefit issue here, which I'll get to a little later on. But certainly the concept is, well, it's my stuff, why can't I waste it, is clearly inconsistent with the value of lo sashchit. So that's really the most basic rule. Now, there's a second group of halachot, which is actually more complicated. And the Hebrew term for these halachot, it's not really found in the Torah at all, it's only found in the Talmud, and that is harchakat nizikin. Now, those of you who are attorneys or who went to law school, I know some people, talk about the notion of the law of private nuisance. There's a whole body of law that basically deals with the question, what uses can I put to my property that may or may not interfere with the rights of other people? I mean, normally, property is the right to use your property as you will, but there are circumstances in which my use encumbers somebody else's enjoyment of their property, and the legal systems have to talk about, the Latin saying was, you may use your own only in a way that does not harm another. Well, halakha has its own set of laws governing private nuisance. What is it that you can do in your property And what can you not do because it wrongfully interferes with the enjoyment and possession of other people? A few examples. There are laws regarding noxious smells. You cannot conduct in a residential area certain activities like leather tanning, because tanneries used to use dog excrement and the like. Various activities that involve smoke, so you have smoke pollution. Vibrations, you can't do jackhammering at 3 o'clock in the morning. Meaning, perhaps we would not call this, perhaps an environmentalist wouldn't call this an environmental concern, because it's not a direct concern with the environment, but it's an interpersonal concern in which you cannot do things that interfere with the use and enjoyment of other people, whether it involves noxious smells, smoke, vibration. There's a rule, for example, that if you have a threshing floor, you're threshing grain, and little particles of grain go all over the place, you have to have a 50 cubits, which is 100 feet, 100 feet radius on all sides in order to prevent the air of the other person's property being filled with these little particles that could cause difficulty in breathing. So we have clear rulings regarding air pollution. Water, well, there is a rule that basically says a person cannot bathe in drinking water if you're drinking from a river, and if you have a communicable disease, you cannot even bathe in bathing water. Obviously, all of this is a concern, not perhaps for the environment as a separable entity, but for a wrongful or an excessive interference with the rights of other people to enjoy their use of property. Now, of course, the Chafetz Chaim points out an interesting point. He says that certainly to engage in activities that take away people's sleep is actually a great offense. That's even called Gezel Shina, stealing sleep. And he makes the point that theft of sleep is even worse than theft of money, because theft of money can be made up with restitution, and theft of sleep can never be made up. Like lost sleep, you know, you're always going to be permanently behind. There are zoning rules, other types of zoning rules, regarding the opening of businesses in residential neighborhoods, which will increase traffic and commotion and congestion. That indeed, at a time when societies were operating under Jewish law, which unfortunately is not the case today in Jewish communities, but when there was Jewish legal autonomy, what you had was you had a situation where these types of things could be enjoined. Interestingly enough, the one exception is a yeshiva or a Jewish educational school. Meaning to say, if I want to open up a school in a residential area, that cannot be enjoined, because we are told the more study of the Torah there is, the better society is, and consequently, that's the one thing that cannot be stopped. In fact, that even gets involved in the law of unfair competition. Halakha recognizes a certain degree of monopoly rights in terms of not allowing a competing business to open up under certain circumstances, but if that competing business is enjoined, it cannot be enjoined based on the principle Chinat Sofrim Marbe Chachma, which means jealousy and competition among scholars increases wisdom where everybody tries to do a better job. Okay, so that's a halachic construct that is called Harchakat Nizikin, which corresponds more or less to the law of private nuisance, which reflects, as it were, as I said, not an environmental concern per se, but an interpersonal concern for the negative effects of air, water, noise, and smell pollution on the rights of other people. There's a third halakha, which is a little less obviously connected to this, but if one goes into the interpretation of it, one sees an interesting thing. And that is something called a midrash. Now let me explain what a midrash is. The Torah says that in Israel, when the tribe of Levi were given 48 cities, right, because they were dispersed throughout Israel as the teachers of Israel, so the Torah requires that around every Levite city there be parklands, a radius of 1,000 amos, which is 2,000 feet, radius around every city, as dedicated parkland where the city cannot encroach. Many commentaries, including Maimonides, suggest that this was not only a directive to the tribe of Levi, but this was a general principle in architectural and city planning that every city had to have dedicated parkland around it so that people could enjoy the grass and the trees and the like. Not only that, but there was a rule that dedicated parkland could not be appropriated for urbanization, even if you would then have more parkland. In other words, let's assume you want the city to expand, and you'll simply make another park around it. Can't do that. Rav Shimshon of Baal Hirsch points out that this is a very interesting insight into urban planning, because essentially, the Torah set up a system where urban boundaries cannot be expanded. If you have a population need, go and start a new city, but don't create a megalopolis of simply a city that we say we have one city going from Boston to Miami, more or less. And city planners will tell you that indeed the small contained urban villages are, number one, a safer environment, a more collegial environment, where people know each other, there's a greater sense of responsibility, and this very principle that you cannot encroach on the parkland is not only an environmental concern in terms of having the park, but it also prevents the urban sprawl that has been relatively destructive of social cohesiveness and the sense of camaraderie that can exist in an urban area. So the law of Midrash, which means the dedicated parkland, is also has a sensitivity towards the appropriate way in which an urban environment ought to be organized. A fourth halachic category, we have a number of enactments in the Talmud that are for the purpose of what is called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is to enhance the habitation and beauty of the land of Israel. Special concerns. Now, of course, this is why it's especially distressing, as I'm sure many of you know, Israelis, well, as a general principle, Israelis have not become quite as sensitive, perhaps, as Americans have to the environment, and thus you can walk in Jerusalem and other places, and you will often see garbage that's strewn and the like. But if anything, the halacha for Eretz Yisrael is even stricter than it is for anywhere else. We have many laws to enhance the beauty and the inhabitation of Eretz Yisrael. Let me give you a few examples. One is somewhat of an odd case, but it's an interesting principle. Let's assume I have olive trees by the bank of a river, and a river comes by and sweeps my trees away and somehow plants the trees in somebody else's yard. Although that person has to pay me, I do not have the right to remove those trees. And the theory is, because if he gets to keep the trees and I'll probably plant new trees, you now have two trees instead of one. And in order to enhance the beauty of Eretz Yisrael, the more trees, the better. So if you lost your tree, he gets to keep it with compensation, and you will plant another tree. Another rule, the Talmud says that in areas where crops are growing, one is not allowed to raise sheep or goats. You know, sheep have been termed woolly mammoths. I'm sorry, woolly locusts, not woolly mammoths, woolly locusts, because they really are like locusts. They consume all the grass in an area. And generally speaking, it was actually prohibited under Jewish law to raise sheep and goats, except in deserts or isolated areas, but not where there was significant grass and grain growing, because they would destroy it. It is recorded there was a daily garbage removal in Jerusalem. Furnaces or incinerators were not allowed in the holy city in order that the walls should not be marred with smoke and smudge. A very, very great rabbi, the Alter of Slobodka, who lived in the beginning of the 20th century, the old man of Slobodka, when he was in Israel, he would pick up every little piece of trash that he saw, because he said this was a fulfillment of the mitzvah to make the land of Israel beautiful. Okay, so when you pick up any gum wrapper, whatever it is, you're actually doing a mitzvah of making Israel beautiful. Now, let me point out, in the Rabbinic mind, physical beauty and aesthetic considerations were not an end in and of itself. But the belief was that a person's physical environment is very conducive to the serenity of spirit and the peace of mind that allows one to be connected to the Almighty. And certainly, the more pleasing the environment is, the more serene, the more calm one is, and as a result, one is then able to be more creative, more functional, doing more in the world, connecting more to God and the like. So we've mentioned so far the law of Baal Tashrit, the various laws concerning private nuisance, the aspect of city planning, as we see from the dedicated park, and special enactments for the benefit of the land of Israel. Let me mention yet another category, because you can see that these categories come from different branches of Jewish law, and yet they ultimately converge and express a great sensitivity towards environmental concerns. There is a law in the Torah, and maybe this would apply to some of you, that if you have a flat roof, you are obligated to put a fence around the roof so that if somebody walks on the roof, they don't fall off. This is called ma'akeh. It's a law that applies in a very literal sense. But Maimonides teaches us, once again, that just like Baal Tashchit, although it is written in connection with fruit trees, is not a law that is limited to fruit trees, but it expresses a general principle, so too the law of ma'akeh, the fence, expresses a general principle that one is not allowed to engage in behavior that unreasonably endangers either their own life or the life of others. So when we talk about bungee jumping just for fun, that would generally not be encouraged because of sakana. Smoking is actually a matter of great, great controversy. There are many that say Jewish law would prohibit smoking because of the well-known dangers to health that it has, as well as even secondhand smoke does create a certain amount of dangers as well. Other rabbis point out, well, people have been smoking for many, many years. And again, statistics are a little misleading here because, you know, Mark Twain once remarked, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. Because, you know, it's tricky.
Is it Israeli?
Okay, well, I remember it from Mark Twain, but okay. The thing is, you can have behavior that increases a risk factor by many, many times, but it's still only a minority danger. In other words, if we say, for example, smoking increases the risk of lung cancer or emphysema by a certain multiple, 1,000 times more likely, whatever it would be, that still might mean, you know, 1 out of 1,000, etc. So there is an issue, halacha, which is really the same issue that environmentalists face all the time regarding risk assessments. And that is, when does an activity become sufficiently dangerous that it ought to be prescribed? For example, many people will be taking the Beltway going home. Now, every time you get into a car, there is certainly a possibility that, God forbid, there might be an accident. When you get up in the morning, you know, things might happen. Now, obviously, there is no rule in Jewish law that says thou shalt not do anything that is dangerous, because living is dangerous. Okay? So, obviously, what we're dealing here is we're dealing with the difficult issue of what is a reasonably acceptable risk and what is an unreasonable risk. Now, riding on a bus in Israel, for example, is not an issue that people debate. Well, of course, because of suicide bombers, but I'll tell you a little joke about that. They have a story about the Eged bus driver. A great rabbi died and went up to heaven. And he was told to wait for a while. They have to go through his credentials. And then the Eged bus driver died, and he went up to heaven, and he got in right away. So the rabbi said, you know, I've been studying the Torah all my life, and I'm a righteous person. Why do you keep me waiting? So the answer was, how many prayers did you make people say? You know, have you ever been in the Israeli buses? Okay, yeah. But be it as it may, the Talmud has a bit of an obscure explanation for what are called acceptable risks. It quotes a verse in the Psalms that we actually say in Hallel that says, Shomer Pesayim Hashem, God protects the foolhardy. Meaning, if enough people behave as if a certain risk is normal and acceptable, you're allowed to take it. God will protect them. Now, obviously, this changes with societal perceptions. 50, 60 years ago, although there was some preliminary research that cigarettes were bad for health, some people were even saying cigarettes were healthy. If you go back to cigarette advertising, in the 1930s, they were talking about the benefits of clearing the nasal passages and aiding digestion and everything else. They were actually saying it's healthy for you. So things that could have been permitted at one time, as the perceptions and the knowledge changes, what was once a reasonable risk, even though erroneously so, but what was thought to be a reasonable risk, can turn into an unreasonable risk. Another issue by risk, besides the issue of reasonable versus unreasonable, is cost-benefit problems. Imagine, for example, that you want to use a pesticide that has a 1 in a million risk of fatal cancer. 1 in a million, very, very small risk. On the other hand, if you have 200 million, that means there will be 200 people who will die. It's not like, you know, no one's going to be affected. There will not be a significant number. And if it's 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, then geometrically you're going to have more and more people dying in a large population of people. Now, statistics don't really help the person who is the 1 out of a million who dies, right? And basically, that's the one person who died. But the question then becomes, just to give you a hypothetical, what if the pesticide has a 1 in a million risk of fatal cancer, but it will increase a crop yield by 25% and thereby feed another 10,000 people who might otherwise starve? Or what's the alternative example? Because there are many, many things that we do that do create dangers, but they also result in net benefits for large populations. The question then becomes, the laws of sakana, the laws of danger, how do they apply in those types of calculations? Those are extraordinarily complex problems. And the balancing of that, that halakhic system would have to do, is really the same type of balancing that any legal system would have to do in terms of what are reasonable risk assessments, what are the alternatives? Could we get the crop yield without the dangerous pesticide? How much could we get, etc.? And obviously these issues are fundamental issues that all environmentalists are concerned with. So, I'm not going to answer the hard questions tonight. Those are indeed very, very difficult questions. But as a general value, there certainly is a rule. One does not do things that pose unreasonable dangers for others. And as a result, certainly much despoiling of the environment does fall within those particular categories. Yet another issue is a law against causing pain to animals, Sar Balei Chayim. The Torah does prohibit causing animals unnecessary pain. The Talmud has a story about the great author of the Mishnah, Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rav Yehuda Hanasi. At one time he was walking in the street and a calf that was being led to slaughter ran to him and wanted refuge. And he told the calf, go, this is what you were created for. And it was decreed by God that because he did not show compassion for the animal, he was visited with illnesses and sickness and for 13 years. And it didn't go away until one time his maid was sweeping the floor and she came across a nest of field mice. And he told them, let them be alone. Leave them alone. God's mercy is on all. And that very second, the Talmud says, all of his pains went away. Compassion to animals, Sar Balei Chayim. Now this raises really two issues. One is the issue of animal testing. As you know, animals are commonly employed for testing. Some of those tests do involve pain, right? There might be some drug that is put in an animal's eye that causes burning or blindness, or their eyes may even be shut together, or limbs may be amputated, or various drugs may be administered that generate tumors and other pain. And as you know, organizations like PETA and the like have been actually quite violent in opposing these practices, including blowing up facilities and killing people as a result of this. And here I think we have to recognize that this, to some degree, is one of the differences we have with at least the extreme of the environmental movement. The Torah does indeed prohibit the causing of unnecessary pain to animals, but it does recognize that animal welfare can be subordinate to important human needs. So, for example, animal testing for another perfume, another deodorant, something that the world could live without. Indeed, one does not inflict pain on animals for some trivial need to allow some business to make more money on a certain product. On the other hand, if we're talking about the testing of medications that could combat cancer or other fatal diseases, you obviously have to explore all alternatives to avoiding that pain. You certainly have to minimize whatever pain you cause, but one could not adopt a position that that is proscribed. You see, because we reject, I think, the concept of speciesism, the concept that all species are created equal, and therefore using an animal for an experiment is as immoral as using a person for an experiment. We would not accept that particular contention. One does not cause unnecessary pain, but once again, there are going to be legitimate needs. Now, another issue that is raised, though, is the issue of eating meat generally. All right, the question is, well, not supposed to cause pain to animals. Well, when animals get killed, they die, something's happening to them. Is it, as it were, a must a religious Jew be a vegetarian? Well, obviously, vegetarianism is not halakhically required, but the question is it considered to be desirable and the like? So, as you know, throughout history, particularly in the past 150 years, there have been repeated attacks by various governments against the institution of Jewish ritual slaughter. The argument that affected Switzerland to this very day, Jews are not allowed to slaughter their meat must be imported from other countries. One of the first decrees of Adolf Hitler, when he came to power, was to ban shechita in the interest of compassion to animals. Obviously, quite a compassionate individual he was. But that was his thing, to have compassion for animals. Now, I don't have time to review all of the scientists. Some things are a matter of controversy. But most who have examined the matter have concluded that the Jewish ritual slaughter that involved I don't have time to review all of the scientific studies, and some things are a matter of controversy, but most who have examined the matter have concluded that the Jewish ritual slaughter that involves cutting the neck, the bottom of the neck, is a relatively painless method of death in which the animal loses total consciousness in less than a second, and generally speaking, therefore, the prohibition of Tsar Baalei Chayim is not implicated in the slaughtering process itself. So one should not say that shechita is an inhumane, in fact, it's a much more humane manner of killing animals than other methods. However, a difference should and must be made between the act of ritual slaughter itself, which is relatively painless, and the treatment that the animals are given before they are brought to slaughter. If we talk about, for example, the penning up of veal, who are not able to move around and they're force-fed in order to get a lot of fat and light-colored flesh, certainly it is very, very legitimate to protest and even boycott, in fact, if one wants to take that position. Again, not boycotting the slaughter of animals, which PETA would do or the like, but to boycott the commercial mistreatment of animals, whether they be chickens or cows or goat or sheep, whatever it would be, because halakha does not mandate and even prohibits animals to be mistreated, even though it permits those animals to be slaughtered. So thus, for example, if one would not want to eat veal in protest, that would be a legitimate, again, I'm not saying it's mandatory, but that would be a legitimate response. And that's really the same thing with the issue of fur, because the halakha says that even if one is allowed to trap animals and use animals and the like, one is not allowed to use painful traps that cut into leg and cause torture. And consequently, although there is no per se rule that says you can't use the product, there's no exclusionary rule. But once again, some type of refusal would be a legitimate expression that that is torture that is not for anything that's necessary. I mean, unless you're an Eskimo or the like, you know, you don't need a natural fur to keep you warm, and consequently, Tsar Baalei Chayim would not allow those particular things. Interestingly enough, there is a ruling in the Shulchan Aruch. You know, traditionally, when Jews buy new clothes, they make a blessing, Shechianu, that thank you, God, for keeping me alive. You know, because it's more common for people to buy new clothes than in the olden days. But the Ramah says, when you buy a pair of new shoes, you don't make the bracha of thanksgiving. And the reason is, since the shoes were obtained by the death of an animal, you don't express joy that an animal died to give me shoes. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have leather shoes. You do if they're helpful to you, but you don't rejoice in that particular phenomenon. Because of this, there's a famous responsum by the great rabbi of Prague, Rabbi Cheskelando, the Noda B'Yehuda, that discusses recreational hunting. And he basically says, listen, you're allowed to hunt to get food, although there's a whole problem. How could you eat it? Because if you shoot a, you know, it won't be kosher, it wasn't shechted. But he says, to simply hunt for recreational purposes, he says, is cruelty. And he actually says that it is not the way of a Jew to enjoy killing animals for anything other than actual needs. Killing animals for sports is not something that is considered to be a religiously proper activity. Okay, so the Tsar Balei Chayim certainly has an impact on all sorts of things, animal testing, the way animals are handled before shechita, the force feeding. Now, in terms of vegetarianism generally, that is a difficult issue. It would seem to me, just as a suggestion, that if one is a vegetarian because they believe it is immoral to kill animals for human consumption, I think that that would not be a correct feeling, because if the Torah itself says it is allowed, then how can one say, I believe something is immoral, which God says you can do? If, on the other hand, one is a vegetarian for health reasons, that's totally legitimate, particularly with all of the hormones that they have in meat, or the cholesterol, or whatever it is, although if you're on Atkins, you're supposed to eat a lot of meat. And if one is a vegetarian in protest of the way animals are mishandled, that is a religiously appropriate response. But I think the notion of condemning something as immoral, which Judaism says is a permissible activity, is a little bit problematical. People point out a passage from Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, who does discuss that in the time of the Mashiach, when Messiah comes, we will all revert to be vegetarians again, as Adam was, which is taken to suggest that vegetarianism represents a higher moral perspective. But let me point out, in spite of Rav Kook's writings, Rav Kook was not a vegetarian. And basically Rav Kook felt that only when we reach higher sensitivities in our interpersonal behavior do we then proceed to a higher level of vegetarian consciousness. But Rav Kook seemed to feel that if you take things in the wrong sequence, they don't work quite well. If you blow up a human being because they're mistreating an animal, things are going to go wrong. And in fact, indeed, this has been some of the consequences of the animal liberation movement that puts people on par with animals. Many of you have heard of Peter Singer. Peter Singer, now a professor in Princeton from Australia, is a very controversial ethicist who is the father of the philosophy of animal liberation, of animals having separate rights and the like. And Peter Singer, in fact, when he was appointed to a position in Princeton, it was very, very controversial. Many people were opposed to it. But he wrote a number of books. But his first book was about the notion of the immorality of treating animals in order to serve human needs. A later book he wrote was really advocating the euthanasia of defective newborns. And the concept often is that if you elevate animals to the status of people, you sometimes lower people to the status of animals. Meaning to say, once you abandon a notion of human singularity, you then develop a philosophy of relativism in which, as Singer writes, a 3-year-old chimpanzee is as intelligent as a 2-year-old baby, and therefore there's no particular reason why one has a better right to life than another. In fact, Singer goes so far to even say that one cannot even give moral priority to your own family. He basically said, if I have $1 million, and my $1 million could feed 50 people in Africa a year, then what gives me the right to keep it for my family of five? And he says, therefore you gotta give your income away and distribute it equally. Now, what's interesting is, the New Yorker had an article about Singer a few years ago, in which, unfortunately, his mother developed Alzheimer's. His mother was an attorney, and he put her in a very expensive nursing home, and he's paying for it. And somebody said, well, Professor Singer, under your theory, you shouldn't put all of your resources to one person. You should spread it. And he said, when it's your own mother, the philosophy doesn't work as well. Which, by the way, is one of Balei Chayim. Let me mention a final halachic concept, then I'll move into more of the philosophical areas, which at first glance has nothing to do with the environment, but upon deeper analysis, it does. And that is, there are many laws in the Torah concerning the mixing of things. You don't mix meat and milk. You don't mix wool and linen. You're not supposed to crossbreed a horse and a donkey to have a mule. You can use the mule, but you're not supposed to make a mule. You're not even supposed to crossbreed fruits and vegetables. Again, we're allowed to eat the products of that. The farmer is allowed to do it. You're not allowed to make a nectarine. And what that suggests is that every species has its own integrity, has its own niche, that God made everything for a purpose, and therefore you don't destroy the boundaries. The orange and the plum, as it were, should have their species identification. You may recall that years ago there was a snail darter, a whole dam was held up. The protective dam was held up because it would destroy this little fish that nobody ever heard of before, but nevertheless this would cause the extinction of the snail darter, and therefore certain projects were discontinued. And the laws of anti-mixing suggest a message that everything God created is good, and therefore everything that God creates should be given the chance of living and flourishing. Even from a very practical perspective, the ecology and the environment is so intimately interrelated that any little thing that you change can have massive unintended consequences. You know, it is said that if an extra leaf falls off a tree in China, that could result in the hurricane that you're having in Florida. That's why computers cannot predict weather in the long term very accurately, because there are too many variables that cannot be properly considered. The Medrash has a famous story about King David, who was wondering, why did God create spiders? Spiders are, you know, yucky. And the story goes that he was running away from King Saul, and Saul was looking for him, cave after cave after cave, and a spider spun a web in front of the cave. And when Saul approaches that cave, Saul says, you can't be here because there's a spider web. And then King David understood that spiders have their uses, and spiders have other uses as well. So consequently, once again, the notion of preserving endangered species does have a significant role that can be derived from the anti-mixing. So what we see here is that we see a whole variety of specific halachic rulings that approach the environment from different perspectives, from the perspective of not wasting, from the perspective of interpersonal relationships, not doing things that impair the enjoyment of others, from the perspective of urban planning, from the perspective of not causing cruelty to animals, and from the perspective of species preservation as something that is considered to be good. So altogether, therefore, although we ultimately do go back to Genesis chapter 1, that man is given the mission of conquest and domination and control for useful and beneficial purposes, it has to be done in sync, as it were, with all of these environmental concerns that find their expression in halakhic rulings. Now, let me just mention that I think philosophically, there are four different ideas that are behind these halakhic rulings. First of all, it is said that we love and appreciate God by being sensitive to the marvels of His creation. The Rambam writes that the way a person reaches Ahavat Hashem, love of God, is by being overwhelmed with the majesty and the beauty of the interlocking complex creation that God has made. What does King David say in Tehillim, in Psalms, over and over again? David says, when I see the heavens, when I see the stars, and I see the moon, then I see what is man that you should remember him, and I see the grandeur of God. That is why we make brachot. When we make a blessing over an apple, over water, we think about the gift that Hashem has given us. Rabbi Avigdor Miller was a great rabbi who died 2 years ago in his 90s. He once wrote a 20-page essay which might be called Meditation on a Banana. I can't repeat the dramatic way that he wrote it, but it basically said, when you pick up a banana, think about the color, think about the texture, Think about the fact that it was put in a peel that protects it, so it should be available for you. And every time you eat, one should have that sense of appreciation. Because appreciation is the cornerstone of spiritual growth, when one appreciates the goodness of God, and therefore we contemplate the world. You know, one could give a whole class on lesser-known blessings. Everyone knows the famous blessings on wine, on bread, but you know, there are blessings on lightning, there are blessings on thunder, there are blessings on rainbows, there are blessings on comets. Right? Because all of the natural phenomena should evoke within the human spirit awe and recognition of the Almighty. The Jerusalem Talmud tells us that God will hold us to account for every beautiful experience in this world that we failed to enjoy. Because God's going to say, I put it here for your enjoyment. How could you ignore it? If Shimshon Frau Hirsch, who lived in Germany, used to say that God's going to ask each and every one of us, did you get to see the Alps? Because if you didn't, there's something spiritually missing in your makeup. Of course, he was much closer than we are. But nevertheless, that's the idea. Now, interestingly enough, one might point, however, to a passage in Pirkei Avot, which might be anti-environmental. The passage says, if one is studying the Torah, and he stops his studies, and he says, how beautiful is that tree? Mitchayev v'nafsho, he deserves to die. Which means, don't talk about trees when you're studying Torah. That seems to say, forget about that environment. But I saw an explanation, a very ingenious explanation. The problem with this guy is, he stopped his learning and he admired the tree. Meaning, he did not regard his admiration of the tree as contributing to his spiritual relationship. In other words, the vice is, don't look at that as an interruption. Look at it as a continuation of your process. And because once again, one comes to love of God by contemplating the nature and the complexity of the world. Now, the second idea is that paradoxically, this notion of gratitude even extends to the inanimate. There is a concept in Jewish law that gratitude is so significant that I don't only have gratitude to God and gratitude to people, but I have gratitude to the things that serve me well. I am grateful to the earth, to the water, to the trees, to the air. Where do you find that there's a concept of gratitude to the inanimate? Well, I'll give you three sources for that. One is, if you remember the first of the 10 plagues, the Nile was struck and the Nile turned into blood. Now, if you remember, the Torah says that first plague was performed by Aaron. It was not performed by Moshe. Moshe did not do that first plague. And Rashi says the reason is because since Moshe was saved by the Nile, when he was put in his little basket, the Nile saved him. He had a debt of gratitude to the river that he should not be the instrument of ruining it. So in other words, you have to be grateful to the water. Another example. You know, normally when we start a meal, we start a meal with hamotzi. You make a blessing over bread. On Shabbat, we start the meal with kiddush, which is over wine. The law is that the bread has to be covered up until you've said kiddush. Why is that? Because the bread shouldn't be embarrassed. Because the bread normally is given first place, and now you're relegated into second place, so don't bring the bread on until you've made kiddush. And we owe the gratitude to bread. Bread is the staff of life. Bread keeps us alive. We cannot treat it disrespectfully. Now, this does not mean to suggest, subjectively, that bread feels anything. Some people say you can talk to your plants, but even that, once you harvest it and grind it up, presumably there is no residual consciousness. So you have to understand these things in perspective. The issue is not that the bread becomes embarrassed, but it's a symbolic gesture that I must show gratitude to those things that have taken care of me in my life. Same thing with clothing. If you remember at the beginning of the book of Kings, King David was very cold and he was covered with blankets and he got no warmth. And there's a tradition in the Talmud that the reason he was not getting warm clothing is because he had one time, he had cut, when Shaul was going after him, and Shaul was asleep, he went out and he cut off some of Shaul's garments to show him, hey, see, I was this close, I could have killed you.
And it says he treated clothing disrespectfully. And he who treats clothing disrespectfully will eventually not be warmed by that clothing. So tell your kids, if they throw their clothes around, that, you know, they may not get warmth from their clothing at later. So what this shows you is, at least in a symbolic way, hakarat hatov, there is the notion of, I am grateful to the air, to the water, to the trees, and if I'm grateful for something, I don't abuse it. Again, don't get me wrong, this is not paganism, this is not suggesting there's any particular consciousness to these entities. But the values of gratitude do extend to all the resources that help us. Value number three is responsibility for the future. And that is, you know, Louis the 15th or the 14th, I don't remember, at the time of the French Revolution, or before the French Revolution, said, Après moi le déluge, after me let there be the flood. Meaning, I don't care what happens as long as it happens after I'm gone. Well, a Jew cannot say that. We cannot just look at the world as it is now. All of us have a responsibility towards future generations, those who are not born yet as well. The Talmud has a beautiful story about an old man who was planting a carob tree. And the carob tree apparently took many, many years, 70 years, it says, to ripen. And somebody said, old man, why are you planting that tree? You will be long dead before that tree has fruit. And the answer was, my great-grandfather planted this tree, so I would have it. I'm planting the tree for my great-great-grandchildren. You have to worry about others, not just yourself. You have to worry not only about the world as it is now, but the world as it will be. And therefore, once again, environmental concerns are an expression of responsibility for those who are not yet here. And finally, the Sefer HaChinuch writes that if one is cruel and insensitive towards the environment, towards animals and the like, that develops a spiritual cruelty and arrogance within a person's personality. Meaning to say, there are repercussions that go beyond the particular misconduct. And that is, one develops a sense of selfishness, one develops a sense of arrogance that affects everything a person does. Meaning you can't segment a human being. Those who behave abusively towards one aspect of reality, inevitably there is going to be a spillover in other aspects. And therefore, it's not simply altruistic for the benefit of others, but rather to protect one's own spiritual integrity. One must learn to relate to the environment and to those who are affected by the environment with sensitivity and compassion. So these are kind of some basic ideas. Love and appreciate God, gratitude towards the inanimate, responsibility for future generations, and the prevention of cruelty and arrogance within our own personalities. Let me just end with two midrashim. One midrash gives us a pragmatic message, and the other midrash gives us a more philosophical message. The first passage involves a person who was clearing his field of rocks. He was taking boulders, and he was throwing them over the fence into the street. So one of the rabbis went by and said, why are you removing rocks from land that is not yours and throwing it into land that is yours? So the guy didn't make sense to this guy because he was removing rocks from his ground. What happened was that a few years later he didn't pay his taxes, his property got seized and sold, and he no longer owned it. And as he is wandering in the street looking for a place to live, he trips over the very rocks that he had thrown into the street. And then he says, I now understand the idea. I took the rocks out of the field that was not mine, and I put it into the field that is mine. In other words, what goes around comes around, so to speak, meaning to say that we sometimes think that the things we do towards others may not come back to haunt us, but often we suffer ourselves from the abuses that we perpetuate. And the second story, of course, is really the motto of the Jewish environmental group, Shomrei Adama. It is a beautiful midrash in which when God put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, he told them, protect and preserve this garden, for if you despoil it, if you ruin it, there will be none after you to make it better.
We are the human race. We are the Jewish people. God gave us a world of great beauty. It is our solemn responsibility to be God's partner in preserving this beauty, in preserving this earth for ourselves, for our children. And as I say, this is not to say that there aren't going to be difficult questions, issues of risk assessment, issues of cost-benefit. And I was once in a debate with Alan Dershowitz. You may know. I mean, I was laughing at the subject that I wasn't. Alan Dershowitz, you may know, was raised as an Orthodox Jew. But he made a statement there, and he said, the thing about you Orthodox Jews is everything is cut and dried. You don't have to think, as opposed to me. He said, I have to think through. Well, I just want to tell you that even if one is committed to halakha, difficult thinking cannot be avoided, meaning the issues of risk assessment, cost-benefit are going to be very, very difficult issues. Because obviously one of the costs of progress, to some degree, is that the environment is not as pristine as it would otherwise be. That is the cost and course of human development. Nevertheless, we have to recognize that all progress needs to be counterbalanced with a great sensitivity and gratitude towards the beauties of the world that God gave us, and in that way, hopefully, we will exercise the responsible stewardship of the Avdal Neshama. Thank you.
We're now going to have a question and answer period. If anyone would like to ask questions, we're going to hand out cards. If you'd write them, that would be great. Some of you, I think, already have them. And thank you so much, Rabbi Breidowitz.
Rabbi Breidowitz, thank you very much on behalf of Har Shalom and the College of Jewish Studies of the Partnership for Jewish Life and Learning. We thank you for adding to our environment. We are a richer community by having Torah scholars and public lectures. And as you know, there are many, many other possibilities and times and opportunities for you to indeed enrich yourselves in words of Torah all over the community, both at the college, at your own synagogues, and other places of learning. So if we do believe that our actions affect the environment, then, in fact, the study of Torah would be great. It reminds me, this past week, I saw a special program on the Dead Sea that was on the History Channel. And they were tying the cataclysm of the Dead Sea region with ongoing history and made the point that that people would be well to look at the environment and try to take their cue from that. And if I stalled, we now have questions. Excellent.
Yeah, I have three questions here. I'll just read them in the order that I received them. One more, okay. One more, okay. What would be the halakhic position on vegetarianism for environmental reasons, overgrazing, destruction of rainforest, animal consumption of multiple whatever the word is, but of natural resources, etc. I think that is a legitimate position. I think the only halakhic position that I think would reject vegetarianism is the extreme position that says it is immoral to kill animals, because obviously the Torah says that. But if one says that due to the proliferation of the way these animals are feeding, that you need, what is the number you need? Is it 10 pounds of grain for every pound? Is it 7? It's an extreme measure. In other words, you basically need seven or eight pounds of grain for every pound of meat. I do think that the interest of conservation would justify that approach. In other words, my point is, one can use a whole variety of environmental concerns as long as you don't condemn the actual killing as an immoral act. Because that, I think, would run against the halakhic structure of the Torah. How does Judaism allow eating meat when there are so many other alternatives to nutrition? Well, you know, again, God basically does say that the animal kingdom does exist to serve human beings. I will say, too, and you may not accept this premise, but if you subscribe to the mystical Kabbalah,
The Kabbalah actually says that an animal's soul is elevated when it is incorporated inside of a human being, and the animal actually is very happy to be eaten, in a sense. But okay. But as I say, this is a Kabbalah. Some people do not accept those types of premises. Please comment on stem cell research. Well, again, it's not directly on this topic, although I have another talk on stem cell research. The idea of stem cell research, and I guess we mean embryonic stem cell research, because that is really the controversy of destroying the embryo. We believe that until an embryo is transplanted into a uterus, it does not yet have the status of life that needs to be protected. And as a result, an externalized pre-embryo or embryo, depending how you refer to it, can be utilized if it can provide potential life-saving benefits for others. Meaning to say, you don't cross into the line of abortion until there is implantation in the uterus. Now, it may very well be that halakha would not support the deliberate creation of embryos for research purposes, but these are so-called spare embryos, meaning to say, these are embryos that are going to be destroyed anyway. They're going to be flushed down the toilet anyway. They're not going to be adopted. And if the issue is going to be that they're going to be destroyed anyway, why should they not be used for beneficial purposes, particularly since they're not yet implanted? So I would say that as long as the embryos were not deliberately created for research purposes, halakha would broadly validate the obtaining of stem cells from what are called spare embryos that were generated for fertility purposes. Clearly, you say, do not destroy trees. What about Palestinian olive trees? No, it is a good question. This law against destroying fruit trees is a very, very severe prohibition. There's a great rabbi who lives in Jerusalem where his whole apartment building is built around a tree. There's some tree growing in the middle of the hallway with a hole in the roof. And you're right. Destroying a fruit-bearing tree is a very serious issue. The only justification would be if it is necessary to save a life. Meaning to say, if in a time of war or terrorism, a tree or a body of trees are able to shield terrorists or hostile enemies, so in that case, one would have to do what one would have to do. In other words, the prohibition of the Torah, which you might say, well, isn't that also talking about time of war? That's true, but there you were cutting down the trees to use as an offensive weapon or something. But that was not where the actual enemies were hiding in the trees. So you are correct, it's something that needs to be considered, but overall, pikuach nefesh, the saving of lives, would supersede that. You mentioned as a third topic, differences with environmentalists. What are they? Yeah, my main point was that there is a segment of the environmental movement, and it might be a small segment. I'm not saying it's characteristic of everyone, that really regards the human being as a co-equal entity with all the other forms of life that exist on the planet, and it is a form of racism or speciesism to prefer human wants over other environmental needs. For example, the late Justice William Douglas once suggested in a dissent that trees and animals ought to have an independent right to sue for violations of their environment. They ought to have standing for it. They wouldn't sign the pleading, so to speak, but whatever it is, those lawyers could represent the direct interests of animals. I think that, and of course that's Peter Singer's idea as well, that the animal is just as good as a person. I think Judaism rejects that because Judaism looks at protection of the environment primarily in terms of our responsibility to other people. And therefore, human needs do take precedence, provided they are done with responsibility and stewardship. Now, the truth is, most environmentalists would probably agree with that, although they would draw the line in different places. But there is certainly an extreme segment of the movement that, for example, no animal experimentation, even for life-saving drugs, in which we would reject that view. How do the laws against harming animals work in relation to kashrut? As I indicated, ritual slaughter is considered to be painless. I 100% agree that animals are mishandled. And that is a legitimate objection, and people should do whatever they're able to do to try to prevent these abuses. But the actual shechita itself, is not a painful procedure. Does our obligation to preserve species include the smallpox virus? Okay. Well, you know, there are lines that have to be drawn. I mean, basically, as I say, human life is the highest value here. Things that are dangerous to life, you know, obviously we can eradicate disease. On the other hand, you know, it is important to actually keep some remnants of these things around because they could spontaneously reemerge, etc. You never really know the nature of genetics. When anything is totally destroyed, there are certain risks and imbalances that can occur. But certainly, a widespread eradication of a disease, if not its total elimination, is a desideratum. May a Jew hybridize new varieties of a certain type of plant, new varieties of wheat, and new dahlias from crossing hybrid dahlias? Yeah. the issue of species mixing actually takes on a new configuration with genetic engineering. I mean, the old types of hybrids where you took two different fruits and you hybrided them, now you can take genetic material. For example, there was a discussion a few years ago that some DNA from a pig was put into a tomato. And the question was, is the tomato not kosher because it has pig DNA? Here you have to understand that the way this works, and I'm sure the scientists know this better than I, is, you know, you don't take something out of the pig and stick it in the tomato. Rather, there's kind of a replication of DNA. It's like a Xeroxing of the DNA. So it's not the actual thing that comes from the pig. But generally speaking, there's a general principle in halakha that subvisual phenomena don't really count. So when you're extracting genetic material that is not visible to the naked eye, that type of hybridization would be permitted, as opposed to the wholesale intermingling of species when you're dealing with visual phenomena. Just like, for example, you're allowed to drink water, even though it may contain microscopic bugs. Of course, in New York City, it contains visible bugs, but microscopic bugs. So once again, you know, you don't have to worry about what you don't see. What about Shemitah? This is good. I should have mentioned Shemitah. Shemitah is the mitzvah that is still practiced today by many people, only in the land of Israel, that every 7 years, the land must be committed to lie fallow. And at least one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons is the fertility of the land to be replenished. It is called a Shabbos. Just like we have a Shabbos every 7 days, the land has a Shabbat every 7 years. The Panovich Rav used to go around kissing the trees, saying, good Shabbos, good Shabbos, good Shabbos, on Shemitah. Now, you know that, of course, historically this created some hardships, and you may know that the Israeli chief rabbinate relies on a loophole here. The Israeli chief rabbinate authorizes the sale of land to a non-Jewish farmer. So one guy owns all the land, and consequently they take the position based on a decision of Rav Kook that the land can be cultivated because it's in the possession of a non-Jew. Many of the more right-wing do not accept that heter, that dispensation, and they fully keep the laws of Shemitah. But you're correct, Maimonides does note that this is in the nature of a crop rotation to restore fertility. There are stories about how the Baal Shem Tov was a nature lover as a youth, and how this affected his approach to Judaism. Does Hasidism have anything to add to your remarks about environmental issues? Well, here I would have to say that there is a difference between Hasidut in its origin and Hasidut as it has become. Hasidut as it has developed is an extremely urbanized subculture. You're not going to find, there aren't too many Jewish farmers anyway, and the number of Hasidic farmers are even fewer than that. So I would not say that the present preoccupation of the Hasidic movements is with nature or environmental concerns. But the questioner is 100% correct that certainly a lot of the inspiration of the Baal Shem Tov, there were times that he was a shepherd, there was times when he would wander into the forests in Ukraine and just spend hours and hours in the mountains and the sky, you know, looking at the skies, and this certainly did have an influence on his spiritual outlook. Now, I will say there was one group of Hasidim, very interesting group, the Breslover Hasidim, The Breslov Hasidim are called the dead Hasidim because they've never gotten a Rebbe after Rav Nachman died. Rav Nachman died a few hundred years ago, and they've never replaced him. They still go on pilgrimage to Uman in Russia, etc. And Breslovers have a practice that is called Hitzbodedut, in which you go out into a field, you go out into an isolated area, and you talk to God in your own words, you know, you cry and you shout, etc. And that, I think, is very much focused on being inspired by the natural order. So Breslov is one Hasidus that still does have at least that connection. How do you see where the precautionary principle fits into a halacha from an ecological perspective? Are all kosher poultry free range? And does biotechnology fall into prohibitions of mixing species? Well, that I think I answered with genetic engineering. Are all kosher poultry free range? No, they're not. And again, there is an issue there that needs to be taken up. Now, I have to confess my ignorance. I'm not sure what the precautionary principle is. Is that a particular... Yeah. Well, I think that is normal prudential counsel to take, but once again, you have to examine both sides of the equation, meaning to say, what are you losing by erring on the side of caution? It could very well be that the loss might be greater than the gain. So I don't think you could generalize that always err on the side of doing less damage if by erring on that side, certain beneficial did not come to pass. So I'm not sure if there's a definite answer to that. In view of how one gets veal, how do you reconcile kosher veal? Isn't that an oxymoron? Why would Orthodox Jews eat veal? It's a good question. I'm not here to defend. I do want to say one thing, though. I just want to make sure that you understand the halachic concept. You know, Jewish environmentalists sometimes talk about eco-kosher, that certain things are not kosher because of ecological concerns. That is not a halachic concept per se, meaning to say, even if animals were mistreated, even if there were violations of halacha, that does not make the animal not kosher. There is no, because kashrut is a very specific rule. Kashrut refers to, you know, split hooves and chewing the cud, etc. You can't just say, if something was done in a socially undesirable way, it becomes not kosher. So consequently, one would not say that a Jew who eats veal is eating non-kosher food. That's not true. On the other hand, one could say that one is supporting immoral and improper behavior, and as a result, it would be proper to abstain. But I would not call that not kosher, because one has to be careful in their use of terminology. Does Jewish law set limits to stem cell research? Yeah, I think I answered that. Is the problem reconciling the goat to Azazel? Oh, wow, that's a very, very interesting question. Picking a relatively obscure ritual. You know, we had Yom Kippur very recently. And if you followed the Musaf, the additional prayer, you may recall that one of the enigmatic rituals of Yom Kippur is the so-called scapegoat. That's where we get the term scapegoat, in which the sins of Israel were confessed on the scapegoat, the Sa'ir la'Azazel, and the scapegoat was taken out into the desert and thrown off a cliff, and it died in that process, and that was said to effect a great atonement. In modern Israeli slang, when they tell you Lech Lazazel, means go to hell, I always like the fact that even the profanity in Israel is based on biblical... I mean, something nice about that, that it's based on biblical expressions and the like. So you're raising the very interesting question, well, gee, the Sa'ir la'Azazel, you're just throwing this goat off a cliff, is that not cruelty to animals? I will confess my ignorance. I don't have a convincing answer to this. I mean, the truth is, the whole sacrificial cult raises certain issues that we need to understand. This is an extreme expression of that particular aspect. But I'll give it some thoughts. I honestly don't have a definitive answer for that. Okay. Must we compensate a person who loses as a result of environmental decision by the community? Well, that's very fascinating. You know that the Supreme Court, one of the very, very difficult issues is when are various regulatory restrictions on the use of property constitute a taking, right? The Constitution says that when the government takes your property, you have to be given just compensation, right? If they just take your property to build the road. Well, what about if they have laws or regulations that say you can't do certain things, so your property becomes worth much less? Does that trigger a duty of just compensation? And the Supreme Court has really gone over that in a number of cases, and the line is still not really clear. Under Jewish law, I think the answer is no, because under Jewish law, all property is owned only in a manner that is consistent with the norms of the community. And if the community, through its due process, comes to certain restrictions on land, then all people that have property are going to live with those consequences. So I don't think there's any entitlement to compensation per se. Okay, thank you very much, and wish you well. Oh, you're from Brooklyn?
We're from
Brooklyn.
This one works.